This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Rosalind Fenner has always been fearless. As a young kid growing up in Durham, she often called cabs for herself and took them alone wherever she wanted to go. In high school, she spent a week doing a ride-along with an officer in the Durham Police Department. And at the age of 22, she embarked on a 25-year career as a special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration, including stints in Guatemala, Bolivia, New York City, and Puerto Rico. She's now an adjunct professor at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh and the president of the North Carolina chapter of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. Rosalind Fenner joins me on the State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. I'm so excited about being on your show today.
It is great to have you. Tell us about growing up in Durham. Your parents had a corner store?
Well, it was actually my grandparents, both of whom are deceased. Now, but the store was located at the corner of Doward Street and the Cross Street from the East End Elementary School. I don't recall the name of that street, but it was there. And I used to spend a lot of my weekends and after school hours there while my mother, who was a single parent, was at work.
She was a nurse.
Yes, she actually studied nursing at Vance Granville Community College while she was working at John Upstead Hospital.
Wow. And your dad was a long-distance trucker, and you maintained a relationship with him.
Yes. He actually drove tobacco products to other areas, throughout the United States. And, yes, we had a very close relationship.
You talked about that. Apparently, he great guy, close relationship with you, worked hard, liked to gamble a little bit.
Yes, he did. He loved playing cards.
So you have memories of, talk about those because I think it's kind of amazing. Some part of your days with him included hanging out in the cab, right?
No, not so much hanging out in the cab. Sometimes I never rode around in his truck, okay. Mind you. But on some of his off times, he would come pick me up. We would enjoy maybe a Saturday afternoon together or during the summer, any day of the week together, just hanging out with me, running his errands, going shopping and things like that. And I can recall very vividly one time when he actually went to play cards. I didn't know it at the time, but I can recall going to Kentucky Fried Chicken, getting my two-piece snack meal and my orange soda, and sitting in the back seat of the car. And he would tell me, "I'm going to go in real quick, and I'll be back out," very quickly. And it would be daytime, and so I can recall, sitting in the back seat, my meal and, reading a book or something and eventually falling asleep. And then him coming out, having won some money, of course,
yeah.
In most instances. And, telling me, okay, well, tomorrow we're going to be able to go shopping again. And, one of the things he would do after that, a lot of times he would tell me things. Sometimes my dad will mumble. And so I would ask my mom, why does he mumble, at the end of some of the things he says? And she says, because he may or may not come through with some of the things that he's told you. And so that's why sometimes he would do the little mumbling thing. And, we had some pretty good times.
You maintained a close relationship with him. And, of course, you were living with your mother and also a pretty fearless child on your own, kind of independent. Right?
Yes, I would have to say my mother did a great job with us, and she treated us independently. There was no favoritism. We would just tease her sometime. Who's the favorite? Who's the favorite? She would say, "You all are my favorite. I love you all the same." But she recognized the differences in each one of us. And, as an adult, I can really respect how she helped each of us pursue whatever it was that we wanted to do, kind of nudged us along when we needed to be nudged in whatever direction we needed to go in, basically based on her experience, really, of the world.
And you had your own experiences with siblings. You had an older brother who was bigger, stronger, maybe.
Yes, I definitely had, you know, two great brothers. One sometimes I thought wasn't so great. Because he was quite the bully. I'd have to say he was one of the smartest people that I knew growing up, because he would always make good grades. He would always help my brother and I with our homework. But then there was this other side of him that was quite the bully, because, you know, he was a little bit jealous of us being younger and probably getting some of the attention from my mom and other family members. And so he was quite a handful.
Did that have any influence on you in terms of your sense of having to take care of yourself?
Absolutely. My mother worked second shift and sometimes third shift because she really wanted to be home with us during the afternoons or during the evenings, depending on, you know, what stages we were growing up. And we spent a lot of time with my grandparents when my mother was working, when we weren't with her. And so as the only girl at the time, I did a lot of things by myself, and I got quite comfortable playing with myself, because sometimes the boys wouldn't let me play. And a lot of times they, when I was allowed to play with them, you know, it was only because they needed another person or a referee.
Tell us about these cab rides. When did you start taking, this is a pretty ingenious strategy of yours.
Well, actually, the first cab ride I took wasn't really my idea. But once I did it once, it became like a habit of mine. And I remember either my mother had to go to work, my grandmother may have been in the middle of cooking something, and we didn't live that far apart. So it was kind of like maybe a 2 or 3 mile cab ride. And my grandmother called the cab. The cab showed up. I got in the cab, went over to my grandmother's. She came out, paid the cab driver, and that was that. It was a yellow cab, and of course, yellow cabs were quite popular in Durham back in the 60s. And once I learned how to dial a phone and knew the telephone number to the cab company or access the number from the yellow pages, oftentimes they had that big advertisement in the phone book, I started calling a cab myself. And, you know, I would call wherever it was I wanted to go, either, you know, to my grandmother's home or to her store. And if my granddad answered, I knew somebody was home. If my grandmother answered, I knew somebody was either home or at the store. And then I would call the cab. And I would take the cab over to either their home or the store and say, oh, the cab is out there. You got to pay them. Because they would wonder, how did you get here? Well, I took a cab.
Great strategy. And working, of course, always making sure that there was somebody on the other end. So when did you develop this love for police work? That was pretty early, too, right?
Yes. I would have to say I had a great love for TV. And a lot of times, you know, today people say too much TV, it's not good for you. But I love TV. I had my own TV probably at the age of 6 or 8. It was a little black and white TV. Mm-hmm. And I actually kept that TV probably until I was well up in my 30s, actually. Oh. And I carried it everywhere I went, even to college. And so shows like Barnaby Jones, Policewoman, Cannon was one of my favorites, Hawaii Five-O, you know, all of those types of shows, you know, interest me. Then Chips came along. Didn't want to be a motorcycle rider. I have a few motorcycles. But I was always interested in the investigations. And at the hour that a lot of those shows came on, it was close to my bedtime, so I would have to hurry up and solve the crime and then ask my mother or whatever adult that was, you know, there in the evening, you know, the next morning, who actually did it. And I was right probably about 98 to 99% of the time.
Now, it's one thing to be engaged in the show, even to that level, but were you at the time thinking actively, all right, this is really what I want to do?
Absolutely. That was something that appealed to me, as well as the traditional, you're going to be a teacher or a nurse or secretary.
Now, when you talked to your mom, who was obviously very engaged in what you were doing, mm-hmm. and you said this to her, was she trying to push you off that idea?
No, she wasn't. Like I said, my mother kind of raised us to be pretty independent and supported everything that we did, including bringing home not so great grades. She was always encouraging, and you know, she didn't put you down for a C or a D. She just encouraged you to do better, and quite frankly, gave you tips on how to do better.
You went on a police ride along or you were in high school when you did that, right? Was that your idea?
Actually, it was one of the courses that I took. I don't recall the name of the course, but I signed up for it just because I know they did police ride-alongs. And I don't remember if it was in my junior year or senior year, but I knew that's something that I wanted to do. And my classmate, I'm happy to say, I'll say his first name. His name is Danny. He's actually on the Durham Police Department currently. And, you know, he was one of our football players, star athletes. And so I was an athlete as well. And so we got to ride together with the police officer whom, please forgive me, I don't recall your name to this date, but we had a great time.
Well, we'll talk more about that ride and how it led to a career in some way for Rosalind Fenner, who spent 25 years in the DEA. And we'll continue that conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, and I'm talking today with Rosalind Fenner, who spent more than two decades as a special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration. She now teaches criminal justice at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Talk about that ride-along. Did that have much of an impact on you? You were already thinking about a career in criminal justice. What was it like to actually be sort of on the scene and doing the work?
Absolutely, Frank. It definitely had an impact on me. And as I said, my classmate as well, who actually became a Durham police officer. Yeah. And so for me, I was excited about it. I was all geared up about it. And then I learned, hey, wow, you know, there's a height requirement for being in law enforcement, at least at that time. And so I didn't meet that criteria, but it still was something that was a driving force in me that wanted to be in law enforcement. And some of the things that we did during the ride along, we actually weren't up close and personal on the calls, but the officer would, you know, listen to the radio, hear certain calls, and we would kind of go probably, I would say, within 200 yards of the particular incident. It wasn't anything major. We would listen to the radio, what was being called out on the radio. He would explain certain things that were occurring. And so to me, that was very, very exciting.
So you're getting more excited about this. It's becoming a reality. At the same time, you're in high school. Your father passed away, and that had an impact on you, didn't it?
Well, actually, my father passed away the summer before my senior year. Yeah. And, you know, my family, actually, you know, I grew up with a lot of love from extended family, my immediate family, and my neighbors and my friends, teammates, because I was always on some team. And, you know, what was really missing and what it came down to, everything that I did during my senior year, he wasn't there. And so when I graduated from high school, I was like, okay, high school graduation. I had all this family around. My dad's not here. And, you know, people always say, well, he's there in spirit. You know, he's always going to be with you. And, you know, that's the reality of things, and that's true. And a lot of times, you know, when you do something, you think, you know, I wonder what he thinks about this.
Did that have an impact on you? Because I know you announced that you were not going to college.
Yes. My mother, you know, I said, I don't think I want to go to school right away. I'm going to go, but I don't want to go right away. And if you knew my mother at all, my mother was like, oh, okay, if that's what you want to, if that's what you want to do. But at the other, you know, on another note, she had a different idea.
Yeah, she sure did. You went to college by accident. Tell us how that application got there.
Absolutely. I went to college by accident in terms of, you know, when I got started. Mm-hmm. I was always planning to go. Wasn't planning to go as soon as I did. But what happened was my brother was enrolled. He attended St. Augustine's College, now known as St. Augustine's University. And, you know, he was having such a great time in school. And so after hearing my thoughts on when I would enroll in college, my mother asked him to bring home a college application. And so he did. And, you know, my mother would drop little hints, you know, about St. Augustine's. And, you know, I would hear her out, you know, here and there, you know, as an astute daughter. Uh-huh. And I remember one day getting a letter in the mail. And, you know, my mother shows me this letter. And it said that I had been accepted to St. Augustine's College. And I was like, well, I didn't apply to St. Augustine's College. And she says, oh, yes, you did. You know, in addition to that, you have a partial volleyball scholarship. And I said, I do. She said, yes, you do. And as a matter of fact, next week, you're going to go to freshman orientation. And I said, I am. She said, yes, you are. That's if you want to. And I'm thinking, okay, you've done all of this. Now you're telling me if I want to. All right. And so, of course, I'd been familiar with the institution as my brother was, you know, a student there. And beautiful campus, you know, very nice people that I met that interacted with, you know, my brother. He would bring home his roommates, you know, during breaks and things like that. And so I said, well, you know, I'll go to this freshman orientation. I'm thinking in my mind, it'll be sort of like a camp. So I'll go. This is what you want me to do. And so I attended freshman orientation. And Frank, I have to tell you, I fell in love with the campus. I fell in love with the administrators. I fell in love with my potential roommates. I met these great people, and I couldn't let them down. We had already picked out our rooms, our dorms, and I couldn't let them down. I had to show up.
Kind of scary how well your mother knows you, isn't it?
It's very scary, and she knows me even to this day.
Bless her. She was on it. Your someday was no way to her, so she does the application. You're there, and you are enjoying. Do you have a good time? You majored in criminal justice?
Yes, sir, I did.
So tell us how you then ended up at the DEA. You were pretty young when you got started with them. How did that happen?
Very young. While at St. Augustine's, I actually had an opportunity to be the student representative on the Board of Trustees under Dr. Prazelle R. Robinson, who was, you know, the president of the institution during my tenure. And I, you know, I was a Delta. I played on the volleyball team, played on the softball team. So I was very involved in a lot of things on campus. One of the things as a senior that was required was that we had to fill out a senior packet at the beginning of our senior year. And that included, I'll never forget, an SF-171. And that's the government, that was the government application for any job in the federal government. And I had to fill out a state application. I had to write a letter requesting an interview. I had to write a letter as if I had the interview. And a thank you letter.
Why don't you ask your mother to do it?
Oh, no. By this time, I was very independent at this point.
Okay.
You know, 21 at this point, yep. You know, very, very independent. And I didn't need my mom to write any letters for me at that point. She had already pushed me out the nest. And so I was on my own with a lot of backing and support from the family.
That's good. So, and then, but the DEA, now how'd you make the connection with them? Did you apply deliberately to them? Did they find you?
No, this was a part of the senior packet. At the time, within DEA, there was a lawsuit filed by black special agents, and that started in 1977. And so the case ended in 1982. Mm-hmm. Of course, I was at the end of my freshman year during that time, had no sense knowledge of this particular lawsuit. And so settlements from that lawsuit went out in like 1984. I graduated in 1985. And in my senior packet, there were some things I guess the DEA was looking for. They were recruiting at historically black institutions at the time. And someone who later on became my mentor in DEA was actually a graduate of St. Augustine's. And so he brought down some people from headquarters, someone from the Wilmington office. And I actually had an interview. I didn't know at the time it was an interview, a panel interview with these three individuals who had looked at my senior packet.
They apparently were impressed because you got the job.
Absolutely. A job that initially I did not particularly want at the time. It was a dream job, but I didn't want it at the time. And then they asked me, okay, well, give us a writing sample and tell us if you were to take the job, what would you like about the job? And so I did that, and I guess that impressed them further. And probably within, I would say, 4 or 5 months after that, I changed my mind. I was ready to go.
So tell us about training, because that was quite an experience that you had in the initial training.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. After being recruited the way that, I thought I was being recruited, that they really needed me and wanted me. And so I go up to Quantico, Virginia, and the experience wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
What happened?
I had some obstacles. And my obstacles was that I was 22 years old. At that point, I turned 23. I was young. I was an African-American female. And as some other people put it, I had an attitude problem. And I'm thinking, well, I don't have an attitude problem. I think you just can't adjust to my outgoing personality at this young age who's able to articulate how she feels. And so that's kind of what I was confronted with.
You even got taken off a roster, right? Am I right? I mean, they know.
Yes. Yeah. I went halfway through the training, and one of the things that they thought I would do would fail firearms. I even had some remedial training, doing firearms. I actually passed firearms, and I think they were really hoping that I would fail. And one of the things that I would notice about the training at the time, and I have to admit that DEA has changed this since that time, the range instructors would always be behind the females. And so it would give you added pressure, almost like with somebody on your back. They were making sure that, they watched us.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just me. It was all of us. They would always be behind us, which would make you nervous in the first place. And so we had to, kind of forget about, their presence a lot of times. And so I actually made it through firearms, and coming back from making it through firearms, because I think they thought I was going to fail, we need to have a conversation because now you're going to leave the program because of your injury to your knees. I developed tendonitis in my knees.
But you also noticed there were other people on the job with what seemed to be more serious injuries, and this word attitude, which may or may not be applied across the board evenly, was applied in your case. Did you make a point of that?
How I found out, I didn't even know it was for my attitude. I found out you know, probably about a year later that that was the other reason. But it was very ironic that how I found out, but I'll get to that probably later in the story. But there were other people who were in training. You know, like I said, I was an athlete in college, so I went into the academy. Day two, you do what's called the physical fitness test. I passed the physical fitness test. You would have two more doing, you know, throughout training. There were individuals who hadn't passed the physical test, male and females, and, you know, they were injured and they still didn't pass the PT test. So then we got ready for practical exercises, you know, surveillances and mock, you know, enforcement operations. And then they said that, well, you're going to have trouble with your tendonitis that I developed getting in and out of the car. Yeah. So I'm thinking,
how did you find out about that?
About the attitude part?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I would hear later that during the academy, they would post our photos up at the end of every week and have something to say about each student. And so at this point, the assistant to the special agent in charge of training reported to the training academy. He was an African-American male who later on became one of my mentors in DEA. When they were going across and they were ready to you know, give a reason to dismiss me, you know, we're going to dismiss her for tendonitis in her knee. She's injured and she has an attitude problem. And so he raised the point, you know, this is one of the, you know, advocates during the Black lawsuit. He said, well, wait a minute. Are you sending her home because she's injured? Are you sending her home because you think she has an attitude problem? Because everybody was bringing up this attitude. But what they classified as an attitude problem, you would classify today as someone as knowing, you know, what they want, being assertive, you know.
But I guess it speaks to even having a multicultural group so that people who are tuned to that, because if you did find out, if you did listen to that word attitude, it did not apply. No one used it when they applied when they were talking about white men, I would guess. But nobody hears that. And so unless you have somebody else with a different set of values and a different experience, not even going to notice, and you wouldn't have been on the force. You made it. And you've done some amazing work. You eventually ended up on Operation Snowcap. Tell us about that.
Well, that's a funny story how I ended up, you know, in you know, being involved in that operation. Definitely a rewarding opportunity. I lost some dear friends during Operation Snowcap.
Remind us what it was. Remind us about what that operation was.
It was definitely a mission that took place in countries like Guatemala, Peru, and Bolivia. And I spent my time in Guatemala initially dealing with the pipeline of precursors coming from the U.S., making its way down to Central and South America.
It's mostly cocaine, is it?
Well, precursors to make, you know, cocaine.
So you're really trying to dampen coca production, right? The production of the raw materials.
Well, in Guatemala, the mission was to monitor, you know, those precursors coming into Guatemala. Then I had an assignment where I was in Bolivia in the Chapare Valley, where our mission was to destroy cocaine labs. And then, of course, the availability of cocaine flying out or coming out, transporting out of South America, entering into the United States.
How dangerous were those missions?
They were very dangerous. And, you know, there were a lot of ambushes. You know, we had, you know, small number of us against, you know, sometimes a whole town or a few of the towns, you know, banding together at you know, in some instances.
Well, it's one of the things that you learned about this, I think, on the way when you talk to farmers and others, I mean, who are participating in this supply chain. A lot of people depend on that production, a lot of sort of average folks. We think of the big drug lords and kind of the nasty business that they promote, but a whole lot of people who are economically dependent on that.
Yes, and, you know, I had a way about myself and kind of you know, going off to the side, asking these particular individuals, you know, if they knew what was happening as a result of, you know, the cocaine production in their country and the impact that it had on the citizens in the United States. And the answer, you know, kind of blew my mind. They didn't have a clue, but you have to remember, you know, at that time, there was no internet. You know, there wasn't a big flow of information from these people. You know, some of them barely had walls and had roofs over their heads because of the way that they lived in this third world country. And so, you know, with them not having an idea of what was going on, that was the way that they made money. And it was legal, of course, to be coca farmers in that region.
You were you the only woman on the team? And were, and how about as an African American? How did those, I mean, I would think that you're one of a few, if not the only.
Yes. The two times that I deployed to Bolivia, I was the only African American and also the only female amongst DEA agents and actually some Border Patrol agents.
Well, I want to talk about how that shaped your experience there when my conversation continues with former DEA agent Rosalind Fenner. We'll continue that conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest is Rosalind Fenner, spent 25 years as a DEA special agent in missions around the world. Now she's an adjunct professor of criminal justice at St. Augs in Raleigh and the North Carolina chapter president of NOBLE, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. So we're talking about you being in Latin America on these DEA missions, Operation Snowcap, a very large drug interdiction program meant to interrupt the supply chain for mostly cocaine production, and finding yourself at times the only woman and the only African-American on the team. How did that shape your experience?
Just being part of the team and actually working with mostly all males from the very beginning, even on the domestic side, when we would get together as a team to deploy, you know, to South America, it was a group of agents that came from various locations throughout the United States. And we would be in the D.C. area training a few weeks prior to deploying out. So I was quite accustomed to being the only female in the group from the very beginning, once leaving the academy.
This is when it helps to have had two older brothers that you grew up around.
It also helped to have two older brothers. It also helped playing with the guys in the neighborhood, yeah, and being only, you know, one of the girls that wanted to play football, where the other girls wanted to be cheerleaders.
So. You talked about being in these towns and these local communities at various places in Latin America, and kind of having to do double duty. You're doing drug interdiction by day, but then at night when people needed help, you were there to do that too, right?
Actually, most of the operations that we did were basically into the evening hours. Mm. And then sometimes we would get back in the wee hours of the morning, get a little rest, wake up, have brunch, because it wasn't always, you know, doing the morning hours for breakfast. But, you know, we would have something to eat. And then we would spend the afternoons, you know, in some instances, preparing for the next mission and also having some downtime. And so during the downtime, I would have the opportunity to interact with some of the people from the local, you know, local area.
You were doing all kinds of, I understand you even, did you help deliver a baby once?
Yes, I did. I actually had the opportunity to, you know, hang out. There were some special forces units in the area training a lot of the military for Bolivia. And so they actually had a medic tent, if you will, where they would assist people from the local community. And so sometimes the pregnant women would come into base camp to actually be seen. And I had the opportunity to assist with the birth of a little boy. And so the medic told me, well, the next person that comes in that's pregnant, that'll be your patient. And I was excited about that. I was like, really, really? Yeah, that'll be your patient. So, the next person that came in was actually the cousin of the person who I actually got to assist with her delivery. And so her cousin came in and they taught me how to do an examination. They taught me what to look for. You know, I had no intent on being in the medical field, but I kind of got put into the, OBGYN field very quickly, battlefield type thing.
Just think, if you had spent more time watching Marcus Welby than Barnaby Jones, it could have been different.
Absolutely, but I watched those shows too. And so I did have the right demeanor. I knew how to tell her, empuje, empuje, like that's push in Spanish. And so, yes, I did help deliver a healthy baby boy, whom I got to actually christen. Wow. And I had to find out that, I don't know what it was. They had to kind of go to court for me to get permission to christen him because, I'm Baptist. I wasn't Catholic. That amongst some other issues with christening his baby, I was able to do that. And so somewhere in Bolivia, I have a godson. And I think right now he may be 24 years old, maybe.
You eventually went back to New York and worked there, and I think you earned the nickname North Carolina there.
Huh? Yes. During SNOCAP, I was actually assigned in New Orleans. And so back in 1993, I transferred up to New York, where I was in the New York Drug Enforcement Task Force. And
what I love about it, you've got a story that actually turns the tables on the Southern stereotype. You were a little too fast for one operation, right?
Absolutely.
Old North Carolina was too quick for them.
Yes, and absolutely. That was really due to really my eagerness and my training as a DEA agent.
Well, tell us that story.
I was out. We were out of surveillance, and I was with a group of NYPD officers and some New York State police investigators, and there may have been one other DEA agent, maybe. I think I may have been the only one out there at this time. And we were planning to do a felony car stop. And with a felony car stop, you'd have the first vehicle to pull in front of the suspect's vehicle that causes the suspect to stop. And then the number two vehicle would come right up behind the suspect's vehicle. And then you have the number three, four, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. And so I was actually in the number three vehicle, which was behind the vehicle that was immediately behind the suspect's vehicle. And, I was a senior DEA agent and, I knew what I was doing. I'm thinking we all train the same and I'm thinking they know what they're doing. They're going through the numbers correctly. And so when we make the stop and we get there, I find myself at the suspect's window with my gun drawn, issuing commands. And so eventually they rush, of course, immediately follow, rush up after that. And of course, we subdued the suspect and, get him in the custody. And so, during our briefing, our debrief, they were, after the seriousness was over, it was like, gosh, North Carolina, we have to tell you, we don't do things like that in New York. You went out there, you were so fast, being the first person out there. That's not how we do it in New York, North Carolina. They knew my name, but they always referred to me initially as North Carolina. They always had to make it known that I wasn't a city girl, that I was from North Carolina.
I like it that the country girl was just faster than they were. I think that's great because usually, it's the other way around.
Yes, but I also attribute it to, knowing, or learning how the NYPD operates.
Well, you served on the Equal Opportunity Monitoring Committee, and that was a sort of turning point in your career. Tell us about your work and what you began to notice in that role.
I had an incident that took place when I was assigned down in New Orleans, and I was applying for my promotion to be at the journeyman level with DEA. I had made some very good cases leading up to that point. As I alluded to earlier, I got involved in Operation Snowcap. I didn't volunteer initially, and I have to say it like that because I was you know, at home on Christmas vacation, got a phone call from my boss telling me that I had to report to Quantico, Virginia. And I'm like, well, why? And so I was actually volunteered to volunteer for Operation Snowcap along with another colleague in our division. And so, you know, I went on through Snowcap. One of the things that the agency discovered with people who were involved in Snowcap is that they weren't being promoted to the journeyman level at the same rate as their other colleagues when you compare it with making cases. Mm-hmm. And so there was no real parameters for being promoted once you devote your time putting your life on the line in South America, Central America.
Oh, I see. Because if you're counting convictions and you don't have any, right. You've been burning up coca leaves.
Absolutely. So there was no avenue. So then they developed, you know, a promotion route for people who participated in Operation Snowcap. So the leader or the special agent in charge that was there when I was in Snowcap was transferred out. And so we have a new one. Now it's time for me to get promoted. And he didn't really support promoting people in Snowcap. And I'm like, wow, you know, and it became more of a personal thing, I think, at that point, in my opinion, because of my age, number one. I was 25 years old and, you know, 26 years old. Now I'm applying to be at the journeyman level and I, you know, face this obstacle. And so I go back and forth with the agency on my own. Being very astute, being, you know, able to articulate my side, being able to write well enough to articulate my point, because, you know, a lot of times people don't want to hear what you have to say. They'll tell you, well, put it in writing. Mm-hmm. And I knew how to put it in writing. And I began to write. I also continued to work my cases. And so it became me against the DEA as it relates to getting this promotion. And so a member of the EEOMC, who happened to be that individual at the training academy, who said, if you're sending her home, is it for her injury or for her attitude? You know, I get an opportunity to meet him for the first time. And this is when I hear about the story with the whole attitude thing. Uh-huh. He remembers remembers who I am. And so he comes to New Orleans on another matter. And so we sit down and have a conversation. And he tells me, well, we monitor things with the treatment of black special agents and the application of this court order that the agency is under. And your case fits the mold for this particular case. And so I began to tell him what was going on. The committee tracked down a lot of the documents that were written. And so they said, hey, you did a great job articulating your point. We're going to help you take the ball to the finish line, if you will. And so that's kind of what they did. And that's how I kind of got introduced to the EEOMC.
When you got there, you noticed some patterns, and I think it's kind of interesting, some of the things you've seen, because none of us at this level would notice some of the things that you were able to see. For instance, in searches, the way searches were done, you began to see discrepancies in the way, you know, in a wealthy home versus a person who may not have that much wealth.
Yes. And basically, you know, for me going out, I was all about the mission and what we were there to do. And I did take a notice, and my hair used to stand up on the back of my neck when we would go, you know, execute search warrants. And I was thinking all, you know, search warrants were executed the same. And so initially, you know, it was you go in, you ransack an individual's home looking for, narcotics. And of course, we would have an idea of where the narcotics were located based on our information. And so there were well-known places that people would hide things, including, you know, hidden compartments in the walls and the floorboards. You name it, we would tear it up. And so that was customary to me until, you know, going into more affluent areas, you know, when we get higher up in the drug kingpin, or, you know, higher up in the, you know, the individuals who were handling the money, not the drugs, we would go execute warrants in their homes or place of business. And things would kind of be different. It was pull the drawer out, look underneath, maybe pull out some things. But they're, you know, they weren't doing ransacks.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I noticed that. And I questioned it. I probably shouldn't have questioned it, but I did. And it was at that point I began to really think about, you know, becoming a manager.
Well, this points to something we call implicit bias, which is we act differently under different circumstances, and something in our upbringing and something in the way we were raised has built in ways that we see and act. And this implicit bias, I think, is one of the things that we're finding in our law enforcement agencies. And it gets confused sometimes because I want to ask you, as a law enforcement officer, and we tend to blame the individual officer on the spot at the time. But really, the larger question is this issue of implicit bias, these patterns of behavior that are not as obvious to us as that final episode where an innocent person has been shot and killed. And I wonder if you've had thoughts about kind of how you manage that, how publicly how we talk about it, and whether or not there is such a thing in law enforcement agencies.
I believe there's a number of studies actually being conducted on that. One of my former colleagues, Dr. Warren Dukes, is actually looking into and have studied that issue as it relates to, you know, your individual biases as an officer, even how you assimilate with the other officers coming in, with your morals and your values, and how you adapt or what you do to conform. So there are a number of studies out there on that. But I personally believe it comes back to the recruitment process, the training process, and the retention process. Sometimes it's not as easy to get rid of someone who has exhibited the behavior that, you know, does not look as, you know, for an officer to be a becoming, you know, officer. And so I really believe it starts with the individual. And so a lot of times I believe that we need to look at who we are recruiting first and foremost, what they bring to the table. I mean, there's no scale that says if you put your fingerprint on here, we can tell what your morals and values are.
Yeah, but you have to have a set of
but
standards.
But we can look at it closer.
And things that you're looking for. And I
yes.
think we're sort of out of time, but I think about what they're doing in Greensboro, a police chief there, and in Fayetteville, where they're at least looking at some of the numbers and examining what they're doing so that later on we can come up with a better idea of how we recruit and how we police without pointing any fingers of blame. And it strikes me that that's maybe, I'm putting words in your mouth, but maybe the heart of what you're saying.
It's hard to, you know, point the finger or blame anyone, because you can only go, as I used to tell my agents, it only happens in the four corners of the paper and the ink that's on it. If, you know, you're making a decision to hire someone, it's only based on what you see, you know, when you come in. There's no way to forecast how someone is going to behave.
Rosalind Fenner, 25 years at the Drug Enforcement Administration, now an adjunct professor of criminal justice at St. Augustine's in Raleigh. Thank you so much for being on the program.
You're so welcome, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.